conspiracy. Political research specialist Mae Brussel, whose conspiracy newsletter appears in the Realist magazine, has for 3 years shared with our listeners the fruits of her decades' research into political assassinations and the abuses of power in America. Her weekly commentary relates the news of the week to the evidence emerging about the conspiracy, which allegedly maintains its power by force over America's electoral and executive processes. And now, here's Mae.
Good afternoon for Dialogue Conspiracy. It's Monday afternoon in Carmel, California, June 24th. And how are you today? Sitting here with a pile of news, as usual. We could do four-hour shows, but we'll take 45 minutes and run. Congressman Conyers came out this week, John Conyers, just 2 days ago, in regards to the Watergate affair, and he said, the worst is yet to come. He intimated there's a lot to come. And for those of you that listen every week, that know the nature of our shows and know the subject matters we've been talking about, there is a lot yet to come. They haven't even started to scratch the surface. It'll be interesting to see how quickly the truth begins to come out. We followed the chronology of the little bit of leaks through the last year or two. In May 1973, Newsweek magazine said, wait till you see all the horror stories that are going to come. Still worse tales remain to be told, and you aren't going to believe half of it. Well, that's been a year, and they haven't told us the horror stories. John Dean, in the spring of 73, said the whole thing is still coming out inch by inch with a mile to go, and it may be impossible to travel that full mile. The eternal hope is that someday they won't have to travel the full mile. James McCord had told the Senate Select Committee a year ago March, I made up my mind if the CIA was blamed for the Watergate affair, every tree in the forest will fall. Well, today, Charles Colson's blaming the CIA for the Watergate affair, so we better watch for the trees to fall because they're like the tigers in the story back Black Sambo. They're tangling each other, which was inevitable, and the tangle's going to go all the way back to Dallas, Texas, with the head man being there the night before the assassination and leaving that morning. But McCord has said the trees will fall if they blame the CIA, and today the CIA is being openly blamed by Charles Colson. Bernard Fensterwald, who heads the Committee to Investigate Assassinations, representing McCord now as his attorney, was accused when he became the lawyer of saying that he wanted the White House to scream, that the reason McCord selected Fensterwald as his lawyer was to see the White House scream. Lowell Weicker wanted an investigation of the Justice Department, the Internal Security Division of Robert Marty and William Sullivan, and he said, a year ago, I've run up against a complete brick wall, and I can't obtain files from Division 5. Well, we've talked about what happens at Division 5. That was the group from the FBI with the Defense Intelligence Agency that planned the murder of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King. And when the house begins to fall and you get into Division 5, the evidence will come together. And it was Howard Hunt who threatened, in quotes, to tell all the seamy things I did for the White House, and that's why Hunt is out of jail 2 years and not suffering, because he knows a lot. In January of 1973, Baker said of the Senate Select Committee, there are more bombshells. There are animals crashing around in the forest. I can hear them, but I can't see them. Well, that's because he looked the other way, but the animals seem to be rumbling because it's now 74, and Conyers has warned us, as well as Ruckelhaus this week, there's more to come. In May 1973, there was a revelation of Howard Hughes' game plan, his game plan for the election of presidents that's in the safe in Las Vegas. And we haven't yet seen the game plan. I've said all along that Howard Hughes controls the White House. It'd be nice to see the game plan. And again, in November 73, Howard Baker reappeared with a press conference, and he said America has only seen the tip of the iceberg. And as distasteful as it is to me, Watergate will not be over for some time soon. In March 73, there was an article, the grand jury is probing into the exploits of the plumbers, and Frank Sturgis was being questioned. And the article said, some believe that when the full story of the plumbers finally emerges, it may prove even more bizarre than anything so far alleged. Now, for those that share these shows with me that have been going on 2 or 3 years, we know what that is. That includes the murder of Mary Jo Kopechne, that Ted Kennedy wasn't responsible for, the shooting of Wallace, the killing of J. Edgar Hoover, among other people, a lot of murders that were done to keep this particular administration and the one that succeeds it in power. So we haven't yet heard anything about Mr. Sturgis. And Gerald Ford came out in March 74 and said, being protective, I don't think the country can stand any more bombshells. Ford, you remember, was on the Warren Commission and covers up evidence because he thinks we're not strong enough to take it, and he's only protecting his team. We can take any bombshell they give us, but as an excuse to protect us, they protect their lies. William Saxby came out this month and said the country can't take any more shocks. But that's another lie, because we could take everything that's going to come along, and it's not so bad, and we're ready for the truth. William Ruckelhaus came out this week and said, there is more information that I'm aware that has not yet become revealed to the public. You have other surprises in the scandal. And Representative John Conyers said, the worst is yet to come in the committee impeachment inquiry. So you see, these people know a lot, and they're not discussing it. But there's no way that they can hold back, because as people go to jail like Charles Colson, they're going to begin to sing, and we'll talk about that canary he's singing today. Among the people unindicted in Washington, D.C., it was revealed this week, was Sally Harmony, who helped type up the Watergate tapes from the Democratic headquarters and then helped destroy them. Another unindicted co-conspirator was the late Dorothy Hunt, the attorney William Bittman, but the two interesting ones are John Caulfield and Anthony Lasowitz, because those two men represent the street cop, member of the police department that's brought into the Treasury Department, into the White House, to be at Chappaquiddick, to take care of Dita Baird, to put people into hospitals, to secret them away, to effect social changes, blackmail through whorehouses. These two little rascals are getting off. They're not indicted. They're not named for anything. But everything will come out in its own time. I have confidence it will. And things, just this last week, more has come out than the week before. Charles Colson has a big article in the Washington Post. It was in the paper out here this Monday morning. And he brought up a lot of points, and I'm going to share with them on the air, and then I'm going to read to you quotations that I had in the Realist article just 2 years ago, in which Charles Colson is sounding like Mae Brussel now at the press conference I had in L.A. The points that he's making with his investigator, they're in the Washington Post today, January 24th, are the things which I had in the Realist 2 years ago. Colson, number one, was saying that he had suspicions that the CIA planned the Watergate, and I'll read you his allegations, and I'll read you some of the quotations from the first Realist article. He said the CIA planned the Watergate. He said that last January, Nixon wanted to fire Colby, the head of the CIA. He thought the CIA was behind the Watergate, but that he was persuaded by Kissinger and Haig not to do it. I've maintained that the president does not have the power to hire or fire, that there are people bigger than him. Kissinger and Haig represent the Pentagon and Rockefeller interests, and they tell Richard Nixon what to do. And if they say Colby stays, he stays. Now, one reason Colby had to stay, I'm doing the article now on why was Patricia Hearst kidnapped and making the parallels between the Martha Mitchell kidnapping and the Hearst. The whole Symbionese Liberation Army is a military operation, and if you kicked out the top people, they couldn't have gone on with the next stage of terror, which is exactly what they want to do. They want to put the Pentagon into the streets, send the SWAT military teams trained in the Marines into the police departments, and the SLA was linked to the efforts to put the military in the streets of every town of America, every major street. So they couldn't get rid of Colby. He's from the Phoenix program. He was behind the Phoenix program in Southeast Asia. His agent, Colson Westbrook, was the case officer behind Donald DeFries. And the orders from the Pentagon, if they want to take over America and have a military government, are keep your hands off this existing system. So Richard Nixon had no choice to fire Colby, even if he wanted to. Charles Colson said the president is a virtual Oval Office captive. And he said he's surrounded by high-ranking conspirators and intelligence circles, and he dare not act against them for fear of international and domestic repercussions. In the article I did on why was Martha Mitchell kidnapped, there's a whole section on how Richard Nixon really came to power, it's called, and It's about Nixon, the clandestine agent, the select man who takes orders from the military government and is only a front. So 2 years later, here's Charles Colson saying that he's a virtual Oval Office captive. And that is true. And that he's encircled by intelligence circles. And that is true. He went on to say the president was out of his mind over the CIA and the Pentagon roles. Now, I've said all along and distinguished the difference between the Pentagon, Defense Intelligence Agency, and the CIA, the power struggle. And between the two of them, Richard Nixon was caught in the middle and goes down sinking. He was caught at the time of the 1972 nominations and the elections. He could be murdered by the Pentagon. He was set up to be murdered. I have said this many times. And if he didn't go along with what they were doing. And he is caught between the power struggle. It would be identical to the German army and the military versus the Gestapo, which was the secret army that rearmed after World War I in Nazi Germany. And Richard Nixon is caught in the middle of a power struggle between the CIA and the Pentagon. And Colson has spelled it out exactly like I have tried to explain it wherever I speak publicly or teach at the university, the course this year, or on the radio. Colson said the CIA was concerned that it was being bypassed on policy matters and channels of information bearing on national security. That's true. The Defense Intelligence Agency was copying things coming out of the National Security Council. They were bugging the reports. They were taking papers off the president's desk, and Admiral Moore, the chief of staff, was receiving them. And when Nixon found out in 71, he was totally unable to do anything. He had to reappoint Admiral Moore as chief of staff, even though he knew that he was getting papers through Admiral Redford, Admiral Robinson. These papers were being siphoned off to the Pentagon, and there was no privacy of the National Security Council, the CIA. Now, Colson says that he saw a memoranda regarding the CIA relationship to Robert Mullen and company. Now, that's a public relations office across the street from the White House. And I wrote extensively in the Realist article about the Robert Mullen office. In fact, in the cast of characters that I listed at the time of the Watergate arrest, I listed Robert Bennett, the son of Senator Bennett, conservative Republican, president of the public relations firm of Mullen Associates, and that firm had Howard Hunt maintaining a desk there while he was going back and forth to the White House, and this was a conduit of CIA funds and CIA agents. Charles Colson says there's a relationship of the CIA to Robert Mullen and company. They employed Howard Hunt after he left the CIA and before he went to the White House. Colson said the memos of the CIA, he saw them from the Central Cover Staff, the clandestine directorate, Eric Eisenstadt. These memos were at the house of Mr. Baker of the Senate Select Committee. And Robert Mullen was complaining the CIA forced them to take Hunt into the office. That was his cover, that he was a former member of the CIA, and then he would work at Mullen Associates and then be hired by the White House. And I maintained all along that Howard Hunt was continuously with the CIA. It was just a change of titles or names. It didn't mean a thing that he was with the CIA at the time of the Watergate entry. Colson said the CIA director, James Schlesinger, defense secretary, told Robert Bennett at Mullen that they were to lie if necessary in denying their association with the CIA. In the article I did, I went into deniability and the lying ability of the Pentagon and the CIA, that standard operating procedure to deny and tell lies. I went into the denying of their relationship of Howard Hunt to the CIA, and it seems that Mr. Schlesinger was the man who was telling them to lie, and that is absolutely standard practice for the CIA to lie when you're questioned, and the man who was telling him to lie was Mr. Schlesinger. Under deniability in my article, I had Howard Hunt, 21 years with the CIA, White House consultant on the payroll of the White House at the time he skipped out on the FBI. He worked also for Robert Bennett at the same time. When Bennett learned that two men arrested at the Watergate had Hunt's name and phone number, he said Hunt was fired if he didn't show up for work the next day. Bennett was the fundraiser of $10 million for Nixon, and he made a flat denial that Hunt was anywhere near the Watergate at the time the other men were arrested. You see, Bennett was lying, and I put it under deniability, but now we see that it's Mr. Schlesinger, the head of our defense program at the Pentagon, who told Mr. Bennett to lie and protect the agencies. Colson said the Senate committee was informed of the time and place of at least 300 break-ins conducted by Eugenio Martinez. Now, why didn't the Watergate Committee, in the second article I did in The Realist, I called the Senate Select Committee part of the cover-up. But on page 23, this is written just right after the Watergate arrest, under the biography, the cast of characters under Eugene Martinez, I said he worked with Bernard Barker's real estate office. Barker got his real estate license only the last year. No mention was made where Martinez worked before that time. He had connections with the CIA. Now, Martinez, it turned out at the time he was arrested, the Watergate had his number and payroll. He was still employed by the CIA the night of the Watergate break-in. But I called attention 2 years ago that we didn't know where he was working before. Now it turns out he's been responsible for 300 break-ins up to the time of the Watergate for the CIA. Now, you know why the Senate Select Committee can't go into Martinez's 300 break-ins? I'll tell you why. Because 299 might not be so bad, but the 100th was the home of J. Edgar Hoover, who was poisoned, the Cubans were there, and Hoover was murdered because he had to be moved aside to get that Houston intelligence plan operating, which Hoover didn't approve of, and it was decided a long time before that Hoover would be out of the way, at least 2 years before. As a matter of fact, I have a quotation here of Martha Mitchell saying that Patrick Gray was selected to take over Hoover's position because he was a yes man to the White House. And I also, 2 years ago, was describing Patrick Gray as the man who stopped all investigations into the ITT, the Wallace shooting, Ruben Salazar shooting, the Isla Vista riots. He was the man who was to put a lid on every conspiratorial investigation, and he was the selected man for the Houston plan to take over the FBI. So if a little bit of investigative work a little further, we'd go into the 300 uses of Martinez, which should be done. The Watergate shouldn't end its investigations until we know all 300 break-ins, and then you'd really know what's going on in this country. Another allegation is that Robert Bennett bragged about the new treatment that he got, the news treatment in Newsweek, Washington Post, for stories he planted to discredit the president's White House advisors. And I wrote at length, I'm comparing what Colson is saying June 24th, 1974, to what I printed in The Realist finished July the 11th, 1972. Because I made a point in that article of the power struggle between two groups, one that would be able to murder Nixon in the event that Ted Kennedy got the nomination as an excuse for canceling the elections, and they were strongly anti-Nixon, and the same group could then come in and discredit him if they didn't have the martial law plan. And Bennett was bragging about how he was whittling away Nixon at the White House, and I know that there's a team in Washington, William Buckley and Ashbrook, Agnew, Bennett, Mullen Associates, that was undermining Nixon. And this is the extreme right wing that thought Nixon was too far left, making a deal with China or Russia, not invading Cuba, and they want a real firm military dictatorship. It's this group that were undermining Nixon that Howard Hunt worked with. And Howard Hunt has admitted that in the Watergate Hotel that he didn't use the walkie-talkie to signal Mr. Baldwin across the street that the police were coming. So Colson is claiming that there's a interest in getting Richard Nixon and getting him, Haldeman, and Ehrlichman. And this is true. It's not a case of the good guys against the bad guys. They're both rats. They couldn't be worse. In fact, this investigator said to Charles Colson at the end of this article, says, you all belong in jail. You know, they're fighting it out with each other. And I don't say that one group is better than the other, but they're taking sides and they're whittling at each other. And this is going to bring more truth out if we keep pursuing these investigations than the Democrats would try to do, or liberals or radicals, or most people are so confused in this country on how to take information and use it as a weapon. But these people are chewing at each other, and if we take these leads and follow them, it'll be useful. And Bennett was bragging how he was undermining Nixon, which in fact is true, they were. Now, Colson goes on, a prominent Charlotte, North Carolina lawyer, connected with the CIA, reported back that he took a plane ride with Senator Sam Ervin and that Ervin would steer clear of CIA involvement in Watergate. Well, I don't know what plane ride he took, but I knew that Sam Ervin made a promise which seemed far out the first day that the Senate Select Committee met, and that's why I put the whole opening statement in the second article I did last July, to compare what he said he would do with what he actually did. And the name of the article I did was "The Senate Select Committee is Part of the Cover-Up," because Sam Ervin was reached, and they did cover it up. And I made a point that if four witnesses had been called, like Lewis Tackwood, Martha Mitchell, William Sullivan of Division 5, and Tom Charles Houston, we would have saved ourselves this whole SLA trip. We would have known how the intelligence government operates. But Ervin was compromised, and he took his little plane trip, and then he belonged to the CIA, and the committee never went back to exposing the dirty tricks. Colson says that Bennett reported to the CIA that through his father, Senator Bennett, who's a conservative from Utah, recently retired, I believe, that he could handle E. Howard Hunt and the committee, the Ervin Committee. That the only problem they had was Hunt, that his father could handle them all. That's why under the biography of Robert Bennett, I put that mentioned his father from Utah, because that is Utah country, is Mormon country, and you don't like to make generalizations, but there's a strong link there between Howard Hughes and Senator Bennett and the Utah chain of command. And if Hughes owns Nixon, all you have to do is have Papa Bennett say, don't go into the CIA matter, don't go into that investigation, and the investigation's called off. There's a lot of power. It takes one telephone ride, it takes one plane ride, and that selected official in Washington gets the message. And that's why people are so jumbled about what's happening in Washington today. These people come out with grand promises of what they're going to do, and they get back there and they're compromised. Even an old guy like Sam Ervin is compromised. Colson says he wants to find out the extent the CIA's Watergate role affected him, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Mitchell, Marty and Strong, and Kenneth Parkinson, how they came back and got even at them. He also wants to know who was financing John Dean. See, that's a good question, because Dean is bringing Nixon down. Dean was the one who whispered, I think the room is taped, that the president went off to the window and mumbled something. Dean must have known the room was taped. That's what's going to bring Nixon down. They get him out one way or the other, and every time somebody's moved, we get something worse, like Gerald Ford, if you can think of anything worse than Nixon. Oh, I was going to say he's in town today. I better be careful, but he left yesterday. I'm okay. Gerald Ford is for... I forgot he was down there playing golf yesterday. He's on his way to another city. Michigan, the home of Warren Burger tonight. That's where he is. Now, Charles Colson said, I wanted them to look at the plane crash where Mrs. Hunt was killed. Now, that's kind of funny for him to throw that out. You see how he's not going to go down quiet. Old Colson, he knows what's going on, because in the White House, they had a team working there, Alex Butterfield, and the minute that plane went down, he moved from the White House to Federal Aviation. I think we talked about that a week or so ago. Dwight Chapin, appointment secretary, just wired out to Chicago, United Airlines, Angel Crow, left the National Security Council, went to the Department of Transportation. Clay Whitehead, director of Federal Communications, Telecommunications, made threats to all the media if the story was carried about Mrs. Hunt. Michelle Clark's body was ordered cremated, and nobody could identify these people. The family didn't have a choice. A lot of hanky-panky went on, and worse than that, I mean, that's a kind name for it. Mrs. Hunt and 45 people murdered outside of Chicago one December evening in 73. The end of 72 was already, she was murdered. And Charles Colson is saying, let's take a closer look at the Hunt plane crash. Well, you know, the White House is going to get even with Colson and say, well, let's take a look at what were you doing at Arthur Bremer's apartment the night that Wallace was shot. So these people are going to be clawing each other for a while, and I don't see any end in sight. Colson said his motives for bringing these matters out now is not only to get rid of his own problems, but he's interested in straightening on what's going on in the country right now. Well, if he wants to straighten it out, why does he just say it like it is? He knows enough. He doesn't have to say, I wonder about the plane crash. He knows what happened to Dorothy Hunt. Why doesn't he just say it? But he's kind of a coward, so he's letting it leak out. The newspaper says, in the early days of the Watergate scandal, Nixon, through Haldeman and Ehrlichman, sought to delay FBI investigations into Nixon's election funds through Mexico on grounds it would expose the CIA covert activity, thereby imperil national security. The national security, obviously, was the presidential security. The funds for Mexico have always been the money that hired the provocateurs that kept the elections in the hands of the selected agents. There was Mexican money involved in John Kennedy assassination and Oswald's trips to Mexico, and Hunt was a station officer there. James Ray was in Mexico two times in conjunction with the Martin Luther King conspiracy, which will be opening up soon. There are links from the Bahamas and the Tyrol Club, John Conley and Sirhan and accomplices down in Mexico, Tijuana. One of them was murdered. Knew too much about that tie-in. So the Mexican story has to be, as long as it can be covered up, it has to be covered up. That's why Leon Jaworski was made the prosecutor of the entire Watergate affair, because he's sure not to touch the Mexican money because of his CIA connections to the Houston foundations. So Charles Colson, he said today the CIA has tentacles almost everywhere. And the investigator that was talking to Colson said, answering back because Colson wanted to work for him, he said, but the Nixon administration tore the Constitution to shreds. He said, you know, how do you account for what you guys were doing? You're not so perfect. And Colson says, his answer was, but I'm not sure the guys who are going after us now aren't doing more disservice to the country. That's little baby Jesus. This guy's found Jesus, and he wants to come clean. But you see, it's sort of a relative Christianity or a spiritual thing he's going through. It's better to give up the Constitution under what they had, Nixon and the team, than what the other guys are going to do. I can't fail to see the difference, whether you take away the Constitution a little bit or you take it away one day, like in Greece or Brazil or Chile, and just say, no more Constitution, or like in the Philippines or South Korea and North Korea, South Korea, wherever we've been, you know, overthrowing these dictatorships, you wake up one morning and there's no Constitution. Well, this way it's like picking a sore tooth and not filling it. We're just taking away little bits every day, and I don't see much difference. Colson disagreed that Nixon team were taking away the Constitution. He just said the guys after them weren't doing any better. So that's where we leave the matter. The investigator was working with Colson said, maybe your whole crew belongs in jail. Well, that's a pretty good idea. We can't argue with that. Nixon, meanwhile, is surrounded. He's surrounded by Army intelligence. His friends are leaving one by one. Mr. Nolan, you read last week, Nolan died just a short while ago, but the paper out here this week was calling the Nolan mystery. And I want to, if I have time on some of the radio shows, talk about Nolan. I think that is the first major murder tied into the Foster-Patricia Hearst case. Wherever you have political conspiracies of a high level, you've got a whole string of murders that follow them. And outside of the six SLA that were cremated in Los Angeles, the Nolan mystery won't remain a mystery very long. I think it has to do with funding of CIA operations in the West Coast, the Zebra killings. This was a major operation. We have a lot of troops, a lot of disguises going on, a lot of people wanting money. There were a lot of what Alioto, the mayor in San Francisco, called Zebra killings. There's a lot of white men painting their faces black. The true story of the extent of the operation around California is great, and Nolan was part of CIA foundations, the old China lobby. Allegedly, he got nervous because after the killing of Marcus Foster and the kidnapping of Patricia Hearst, he hired more security guards and became more cautious because he was nervous. Well, I've never heard of a man committing suicide because he was afraid somebody else was going to kill him, you know, and do the person a favor. That's the weakest excuse for Nolan's suicide I've ever heard. And his reputation in Oakland with the black community makes it hardly possible that he identified with the murder of Dr. Marcus Foster. If it was Randolph Hearst, that would be something different. As long as Marcus Foster, I can't believe that he's going to commit suicide over that one. So that mystery is wide open. Meanwhile, Nolan and Chotiner gone, Nixon's old guard, and see Arnold Smith, the old crony, it looks like he may have to go to jail. I doubt if they'll ever pull that off, but he's got one foot in the jail. So the old guard is dying around Nixon, and the new team is taking over. And I'm sure Nixon feels insecure, and he's trapped, but he wanted that trap. We won't shed too many tears about it. Martha Mitchell had an interview this week in the Washington Post. This is sort of a continuation of the anniversary of the Watergate. Last week we talked about it. It was 2 years to the day. But in commemoration of that, the Washington Post had a 3-page article about Martha Mitchell, 2 long years after the Watergate. And it's very interesting. Martha Mitchell compares herself. She says in the article, "I place myself in the position of Patty Hearst many times because I was brainwashed." And you know the article I'm doing now and just finishing this week is called "Why Was Patricia Hearst Kidnapped?" And I'll go into it with you a little, the outline, so you'll know that I've been doing my homework. And I make a comparison between Martha Mitchell and Patricia Hearst and run down the same kidnappers, the same motives, the same reasons for kidnapping each of them, and done by the same people. And it's interesting because I've just completed the article this week and I'm now typing it up, that Martha Mitchell is identifying with Patricia Hearst because their cases are so similar. Martha Mitchell was talking, I'll give you some quotations of the article. There's quite a few, and they parallel again the article that I did on why she was kidnapped. She says, among other things, one point is that Richard Nixon and John Mitchell groomed L. Patrick Gray since 1968 to replace J. Edgar Hoover. In the article that I wrote on why she was kidnapped, I said Gray, Patrick Gray III, acting head of the FBI from the Justice Department, was staying at the same Newport Hotel as John Mitchell family following the arrest at the Watergate. Even Time magazine thought that was suspicious. Gray should have a reputation by now of stopping investigations. And I list all the things he stopped, like the ITT and the Isla Vista. It's little wonder that the FBI chief would not come to the aid of the Mitchells and see who was making Martha prisoner when he was staying at the same hotel. Now, I wrote that, and she wonders why people didn't recognize what was happening, and I have to send her a copy of my article. She never saw it because it's sort of a rundown of what she is saying. I talked about a high summit meeting between John Mitchell and Nixon after the Watergate and using Martha's apartment for a liaison meeting of the team back in Washington. That's why they had to keep her on the West Coast. And what she said is, she says, "I'm stupid. I let the American people down." And I said to myself, "How can you be such a damn fool?" And then she goes on to say she was brainwashed. She says, "Nixon and his colleagues are scared to death of me, and I'm scared to death of them." She said, June 17th, 1972, at 7 in the morning, which was 10 o'clock on the East Coast, Haldeman called Mr. Mitchell, and he got up and went over in the kitchen to another phone, but she sort of got wind of what they were saying, and he was talking on the telephone. And he understood immediately what was happening, and he went out to see Jeb Magruder. They were all staying at the same hotel, and passed the word around. This was 7 in the morning. And she said, under sworn testimony on July the 10th to the Senate Select Committee, Mitchell testified that he was advised of the break-in on about June 17th, almost 3 weeks later when he was with Ronald Reagan at some political meetings. And she said he knew about it that morning. He got shaken out of bed and went down to see Magruder. She said she didn't want to go to California, but they forced her. You see, I always said, and I said in my article, that I believe that there were wires and things or an escape route in the Mitchell's apartment in case McCord got caught at the Watergate in that group, because McCord had been there many times at the Mitchell apartment. And also you could wire the Watergate Democratic offices right to the Mitchell place. And she claims that they forced her to go to California that weekend, which is interesting, and she didn't want to go. She said that they'd been making her and Agnew go, and Robert Dole was sending her all over. And she says she realized that while she was out during these trips, they were doing the dirty tricks. So she only gave in. She felt sorry for Mrs. LaRue, and she came out to California. And they were all at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and early in the morning, John Mitchell got dressed and disappeared, and they grabbed up all the newspapers so she couldn't read a paper, and she didn't see TV. And all the men were talking, their heads were down, and she says, "For God's sakes, what's the matter with all of you? We came here to have a good time." And she says, "You can see this picture, those thin lips, you know, those little beady eyes. You see Robert Martin and Fred LaRue, they look like dead ringers for each other, you know, when they were testifying at the committee. And you see John Mitchell stonewalling it, you know, and you see the three of them. It has to be really funny. 7 in the morning, their heads together, and Martha's saying, "Come on, let's all have fun today, you know?" And their heads are all together, and they're all making arrangements to go back to Washington. She says, "What's going on, you know?" So it's Sunday, June the 18th, and they all move from the Beverly Hills Hotel to the New Porter Beach, and she knows something's going on, and she says, "John, quit. You leave." And he says, "Look, in 2 months, it'll all be over." He says, "You know, and I'll retire, and we'll be happy." She said, he told her everything in the election, the book is set, everything's ready, you don't have anything to worry about. She was worried. She said, "Quit." He says, "It's all in the book." Well, she says she saw the book. The book is called Gemstone, and they've all disappeared. She said Jeb Magruder burned his in the fireplace, and this was the blueprint. And Mitchell told her they had the most airtight espionage system worked out ever, the White House had. And she says, don't tell me about it. I don't want to know. And she had seen the book. And he said, this is an airtight espionage system. Now, that's the system I have said that in the event that the Democrats had a ticket that would win the election, they had an airtight system for taking it away. And that's what the gemstone was. And so she claimed she didn't want to know about it. So Mitchell said to her, honey, you've been working hard. Just hang on 2.5 months. You stay here and rest and swim at the Newport Hotel, and I'm going back to Washington. And she still didn't know about the Watergate. So Mitchell and Jeb Porter and Fred LaRue, Robert Mardian, left for Washington, D.C. And she said, Robert Mardian looked like a newspaper boy. He picked up all the newspapers around the hotel. You could see, here's the assistant attorney general, the head of the whole security division, who's nailed about, you know, 90 or 100 of the most beautiful anti-war people, minority civil rights people, black people in prisons. You know, here's the guy that's framed everyone, thinking that he can run around a hotel grabbing up all the newspapers and he's going to be safe. You know, from the internal security committee, he thinks that's going to save him. So she says he looked like a newspaper boy. His arms were so filled with newspaper. But she called Steve King, who was guarding her, and she says, he got me a paper. She said, I jumped out of my bed like a sheet out of lightning. And she called Mitchell right away, and they were on the airplane, and she called her apartment in Washington, and they were all at their apartment in Washington, D.C., and they were using her apartment back there, and I also wrote that in the article. 3 weeks after they were arrested, they were having their clandestine meetings back in her apartment, and they used their apartment. And then she said she realized what they were doing, but she warned. She says that what they were planning, she says the Watergate arrest in 72 stopped them. She says that was only a dress rehearsal, the Watergate thing. It was true. I mean, just being in those offices was nothing. She says that was a dress rehearsal for the 72 campaign. But she says those practices were the same tactics that they used on everybody in 1968. Now, John Mitchell just started managing Richard Nixon in 68, but she said those were the same tactics. And in the Realist article, when they were arrested, I put a thing here. The same CIA that was busy altering the choices of candidates before was busy acting. This is what I wrote in the Realist, that they were doing their business one more time around, that they do this every election year. And I said two governments have existed side by side, one visible and one invisible. And I described how they were messing around one more time to affect the course of an election. And she talks about their apartments and the dress rehearsal of night. It was a dress rehearsal. And then she goes into the serious business, which I wrote in my first article and the second one a year later, on being held a prisoner, a political prisoner, and Steve King assaulting her and smashing her hands through a glass window. And the FBI agents surrounded her. They're all around the villa, and Gray was there, and she couldn't get out. And she said Patrick Gray was the heir apparent since 68. Nixon and Mitchell, he was their yes man. Then her daughter was brought in. She doesn't have her daughter anymore, custody, and they plied Martha with lots of liquor, and they kept food from her. And they brought the daughter in, and then they took down her pants and had the daughter watch her get an injection to put her to sleep for 8 hours. And she said this was to brainwash Marty and to terrorize her so that, you know, you can identify that it's going to happen to her if she talks. So that Martha Mitchell, these men, FBI people in the room, kept her for 2 or 3 days with no food, just liquor, brought in her daughter, and then took down her pants and gave her a shot. She didn't know what it was, and the daughter was forced to witness it. And the daughter's been removed from her since, and she can't even see her. Somebody called Herbert Kalmbach. She didn't know him. She'd only met him a few times. He came in. She said she was glad to see anybody. But they took her to a hospital, got stitches for her hand, and they used the name Dorothy Kalmbach, which reminds me of Dorothy Hunt. She used an alias, and she went to the hospital, and they were ready to put her in a mental hospital, like Dita Beard. But she recognized the doctor because she'd burned her hands on a cigarette box a few days earlier, and someone at the hospital recognized her and said, my God, Martha, what are you doing here? And it saved her life because she had an alias, and they were going to send her away. And she was so pleased to see him. And then they put her on an airplane and sent her to New York, where she was kept isolated and couldn't see anybody and still can't see her daughter. And Richard Nixon put out stories that she was in Silver Hill Psychiatric Hospital in Connecticut. She's never been there. She doesn't know what it is. And she doesn't know how that story came out. One of the things she said when this person was writing the article for the Washington Post, she went through her daughter's room, showing them their 18-room apartment. There was a picture of John Mitchell. And she made the remark, he's a mean-looking SOB, isn't he? Why didn't anyone tell me that? Well, she read page 29 of The Realist 2 years ago. I said, John Mitchell, one of the dirtiest, meanest men in political history, exposed his little sweetheart to espionage agents doing some kinds of dirty work and distasteful acts. At what point did Martha have to be removed, silenced, and totally discredited? The political princess who once was cleared for classified material when she worked for the Army Chemical Corps was suddenly turned into a negligent, selfish mother, and she got the Dita Beard treatment away from the doctors, from Army doctors and psychiatrists, and she was kidnapped and kept isolated. And I have the thing in The Realist how they threw her down on the bed, they stuck a needle in her behind, they gave stitches in her finger, security agents were around her, Patrick Gray was at the hotel. I feel very good reading the news this week, the Martha Mitchell story and the Colson story, because I know I'm right on target if I can say these things within the day they happen. And now, 2 years later, the establishment media press is ready to tell the things that I told them 2 years ago, 1 year ago, that they haven't been able to face. And speaking of facing, we'll spend the last 4 minutes just summarizing the article I'm winding up so that you'll know I've been doing my homework on the Patricia Hearst kidnapping. I got a call from Indianapolis. A newsman wanted a story. He said, I hear you've got the story of the break in the country on the SLA. And he said, will you send me some documentation and I'll carry the story? I said, what do you want? He said, well, you have the first story on the Watergate and Woodward and Bernstein got the credit. Now you've got the SLA. Send me some material. And I said, what kind of documentation do you need? I said, when I did the Watergate story, the Associated Press, the United Press were there at the press conference, wouldn't touch it. I said, you won't touch what I'm saying because you probably still think that Sirhan killed Robert Kennedy. And he says, well, didn't he? And I said, well, you still think James Ray killed Martin Luther King, don't you? And he says, now don't tell me he did. And I said, you know, your news service and what we get here at KLRB is so different that we're on different brainwaves, so I can't even relate to you. I know in advance where your head is at. So I'll write my article, and I'll send it to you, and then you can do what you want with it, but I don't need any advance from you because you don't have the slightest idea of what's going on in this country. So that was my conversation to Indianapolis. The article I'm doing now, I'll just read you the outline as much as we have time because I think it'll interest you. There's an article in the Chronicle today, a whole rush of books on the SLA coming out, and it lists 8 different authors and 8 subjects. And I can go into them, or I can just tell you what I'm doing, and I'll tell you the Mae Brussels book, which I want to get out in October, which isn't like any of those 8, except for Don Freed, who's writing Sin Q, the Slave, and our books overlap. The article I'm doing, which will go into a book, Why Was Patricia Hearst Kidnapped? Or How Do You Recognize a CIA Espionage Plot as Opposed to a Revolutionary Radical Guerrilla Army? I have a quotation of Charles Bates. You only need to have a tape recorder to set up a revolutionary movement today. The article has 12 sections. The first, Why Was Patricia Kidnapped?, which is about 10 pages long. The second is A Cast of Character. The article will have 24. The book will have 40. The chronology of events takes us right from the beginning of the National Security Council to Mr. Colby, the Phoenix Program, up to today. The next section is the motives for creating the SLA. There are 15 motives. I go into what they want to accomplish and how they're doing it. Another section is called The Telltale Revolutionaries, Conspicuous Banditos and Provocateurs, 20 incidences of their leaving evidence around for specific motives. Where did the tactical support come from? 23 incidences of assistance by law enforcement that they're not talking about. Another section, why the charges on Patty Hearst, how they were created and fabricated. Another on how dangerous was the SLA, 11 examples of exposure where they could have harmed people or hurt them and they didn't. One called the death trap, the necessity to have them murdered. And then a large section comparable to the Martha Mitchell story on how do you tell the espionage plot as opposed to the revolutionary. And I go into the cover story, alias, funding, coincidences, dummy fronts, use of the media, the migratory birds, importation of out-of-state people, the use of specific cities and states, namely Florida, California, and Pennsylvania and Indiana, the CIA collusion, the FBI collusion, and then 33 examples of collusion of the California police, the Department of Corrections working with the FBI and CIA. The final part is the indication it was a right-wing conspiracy, and in conclusion, was this plan and creation really necessary? Well, our time is up. We'll do more next week. Take care and stay well, and that's all for Dialogue.